Pursued vengefully by the affronted husband. In fact, the husband appears to have got Dovogila back, but he still wanted his revenge, and so Dermot McMorrow was hunted from his native lands and went across, remember, originally to Bristol and then into the depths of France to enlist the help of Henry II, the Plantagenet Norman King of England. The Dreaming of the Bones takes that highly special and, for most people, obscure incident. To know something of the incident, you have to know something about the incident before the play can move you. And then, I think, I would argue, and I would direct your attention to this, takes that highly special and obscure incident of Irish history, in itself nothing more than a quaint, sort of antiquarian curiosity, and places it in the imagination in such a way that you feel the theme and the treatment of it is of universal significance. And if this is true, Yeats does this by simply literary means, literary and dramatic means, by the theatrical form which he uses and by the particular poetic style which he brings to bear. It's very important, I think, to recognize this about Yeats. This is another reason for insisting, as I am doing until you're tired of hearing about it, about the Irishness of Yeats. This gives him, in fact, a quite special and different problem from any of the other poets whom we study of the English language in the present century. An American poet has the right to expect, certainly his American readers, to know the main lineaments of the history of North America, and to be able to allude to the past of the American people. And if any readers find themselves a little at sea, things are being alluded to which they don't quite remember, just what was the relationship of Aaron Burr, for instance, well, no place to play the role that you got. And the same is true of an English poet, a British poet. It becomes steadily less true when you move into the smaller English-speaking communities. A quite real and special problem is created for the Scottish poet, the Anglo-Scottish poet, who doesn't merely happen to have been born a Scotsman, but who wants, in fact, to express the peculiar identity, what it means to be a Scotsman. In order to do that, he needs to allude to the past of the Scottish race in all its manifestations, in very much the same way as an American or an English poet does. But because it's a small, and we may say perhaps a conquered people, that knowledge that he has to take for granted cannot be taken for granted. And so he is faced almost immediately by the possibility that he is going to write only for the literate and intellectual minority of his own small, and in many ways unrepresentative nation. And hence, the same is true of the Welsh poet, the same is true of the Irish poet, the same is true, of course, of other sorts of English, of poets writing in English whom we too seldom remember. The West Indian poet, of whom there are some fine ones, namely, Caribbeans, they need, in order to establish their own identity, explain the way history, present history, seems to them, they need to evoke the history of the Caribbean, unless this history is not generally known. And this, in fact, sets up for the Irish writer, or I did, for most Irish writers before Yeats and Joyce, a very highly particular problem, which in the end is virtually insoluble. As the Irish, even those that stay at home, or even if they can expect some help from the Irish who have gone abroad, the Irish Australians, the Irish Americans, still, the Irish public as such, for the reading of literature, is just not large enough for the maintaining of a viable literary tradition. Apart from anything else, the island is too small and too thinly populated, for instance, to maintain more than, at most, three or four publishers, and those very small outfits, with nothing like the marketing and publicity facilities that are available through the big London or New York or Boston publishing houses. The same again is true of the Caribbean, of Barbados, of Santa Lucia, of Trinidad. Hence, inevitably, simply in order to make a living, and this has been true since the business of literature became a vast commercial venture, that is to say, certainly since the beginning of the 19th century, at a certain point quite early in his career, if the Irish writer is ever going to make a living, however modest, he has to get his manuscripts into the hands of a London or a New York or a Boston publisher. And then you can immediately see the pressures that are brought upon him by the publisher's reader. We like this very much, but you must understand that we are promoting it for the English public or the American public. And so there are certain peculiarities, I mean, very important to you, but wouldn't cost you anything to hire it out. And don't make it. And more than that, it's not just negative, but also positively, both the English and the American, too, for that matter, and others, they have a vision of what the Irishman is supposed to be. And you know this stereotype. It is, of course, sedulously maintained, in any case, by the media. And this is a stereotype, and so long as an Irish writer feeds the stereotype of the Irishman as a colourful, gay, dashing, unreliable, comical, entertaining figure, then he will, if he's reasonably skillful and inventive, get himself an American or British public. But of course, that national stereotype is as misleading as all national stereotypes. And so your honest Irishman, or honest Irish writer, in fact, wants to break down the stereotype. The minute he tries to do that, then his British and American publishers say, ah, come on, you know, they're not going to like this, you know. I mean, this isn't, it's not going to do as well. The other book, when you're given another technical picture, the roaming, rambling Paddy, which everybody wants to know about. And so you can see in one Anglo-Irish writer after another, through, particularly through the 19th and into the 20th century, you can see this moral problem presenting itself to them, and in many cases, most cases, they're in fact broken. You find them compromising more and more. Writing this book, which, well, this one has just got to be a pop boiler. We've got to give the British and the American public what they need in order that I can mistake, in order to do the next book, which will be unpopular and which will be truthful. And then you and he triumphantly sold it. Not that he ever became a rich man, but he triumphantly sold it in that he does not project the figure of the stereotyped Irishman. He continually breaks down that stereotype, complicates it, and yet he remains true to the Irish reality, and yet he can and did force us across the English-speaking world to take him as a poet of the wide world. And I mean, the fact that we are here now and that we have been reading about Dermot Gilbert proves it. And this is really extraordinary, because of every danger that he would become a parochial figure, because his subject matter seems to the non-Irish parochial, trivial, marginal. Why on earth do we need to know about what was happening in that little island at that particular period of time? He forced us to do it. And he forced us to do it particularly by the forms that he took. And by form, form means the overall structure, and one also means the form in the unit of the poetic line in terms of the meter he uses, the word choice. He manipulates these in such a way as to allude quite honestly to some of the greatest figures and greatest monuments of the Western European literary tradition. And indeed not just the Western European either, but as he got more confident, to Oriental and monuments and traditions too. Thus, the Dreaming of the Bones is a profoundly Dantesque work. He is alluding in various ways to that perhaps greatest of all monuments of the Western European literary mind, the Divine Comedy of Dante. The story that he tells, the image that he presents, rather, in The Dreaming of the Bones, of the damned lovers, Dermot and Gilla, lost in this perpetually sterile dance around each other, recalls and is meant to recall one of the most famous and immediately accessible cantos of the Divine Comedy, where Dante in the afterword sees the doomed lovers Paolo and Francesca similarly floating in the air in an endless spiral. This is one way in which Yeats establishes from the highly special and parochial Irish reality an access right to the centre, what we recognise as something absolutely central to Western Europe, Western civilization generally. In the same way, you will have seen that his verse in its metre in this play and in others, apart from the lyric interjections, is in fact in Shakespearean blank verse. Yeats, it is worth noting, unlike most of his contemporaries with whom we associate him, very seldom writes free verse. He is, for the most part, happy, he seems a conservative, to stay with the inherited meters of the verse. That's not to say that he doesn't do something distinctive and novel with them, of course. But this is in Shakespearean blank verse. I think one could say that part of the reason for that was he had to do that, he needed to do that, he needed to relate the Irish subject to that other central monument of Western literary tradition, that's to say Shakespeare. In order to do that, incidentally, if this is the right way to put it, he had to rethink totally the history of theatrical literature in the English language, which had brought it to the position in which he found it as a young man when he wanted to write for the stage. In order, in fact, to reconstitute the real possibility for verse drama as such. Remember,
in verse had been written by all the notable poets throughout the 19th century in England, at any rate, and they continued to be written into the 20th century. But hardly any of them were real material for the stage, and hardly any of them, in fact, were staged to any significant purpose. They are wholly for the drama, the poetic dramas of Keats, of Coleridge, of Tennyson, of Swinburne. Even Shelley's Nepenthe, which in fact is from time to time staged, is not really a part of the theatrical repertoire in the sense that a serious theatrical manager or a serious actor or actress in our day envisages it. The drama, meaning by that, the drama of the commercial theatre had become, for two or more centuries, almost entirely a prose medium. The great plays, the tragedies or comedies in the English language, from the very beginning of the 18th century, had been written predominantly in prose. And of course, when Yeats was a young man, the London stage, which is what at that point he was interested in, because it was the only stage that was active, what was open to him, was dominated by two of his compatriots, two talented Anglo-Irish men, George Bernard Shaw and Oscar Wilde, both of whom were great dramatists commanding the theatre-going public of London and indeed of American centres too, over many years by a succession of brilliant plays all written in prose. And indeed, when we speak of, for instance, the prose of George Bernard Shaw, we mean prose at its most prosaic. He is a profoundly, the texture of his language writing well, as he often is, it's very, very fine, but it has the virtues of prose. It is very hard, it is very commonsensical, it glitters with point, epigram, distinction. Yeats knew that he wanted to be into the theatre, knew that his themes required it, and knew that this, so long as they, George Bernard Shaw, Oscar Wilde, dominated the English theatre, he stood little chance of breaking that monopoly. At a certain stage, as we shall learn later, in the first decade of this century, he, in fact, mustered enough finance and enough talent to start the Abbey Theatre in Dublin as a calculated challenge to the London Theatre. But at certain poetic plays, including his own and some by Dominington Sing, were in fact put on in the Abbey Theatre. By this time, however, this is relatively late in his life. This is 1916, it's carefully dated the time, 1916. At this point in time, he had in many ways lost his confidence that the Abbey Theatre could ever be what he wanted it to be, a permanent channel of communication between the Irish people at large and their talented, imaginative writers. Largely lost that because of the way in which the great genius of John Millington Synge was treated by the Abbey audiences. We can read about that. And at this point, in 1916, he makes an extraordinary discovery, and he makes it largely, as far as we can see, thanks to Ezra Pound. This is a discovery of an entirely alternative theatrical tradition altogether, a real alternative, if only he could master it, and he does master it, to the realistic theatre behind the proscenium arch, the prose theatre of Shaw, of Wilde, and of others of the time, like Galsworthy, Harley Granville Barker. And this was the no theatre, of classical Japan. These had been known in the West to others before Yeats and Pound got to know them, and translations of them had appeared in London, but naturally they were known only to accumulated and made done most of the spade work for translations of a body of classic no drama, and who had accumulated information from the best Japanese scholars about them, was an extraordinary man whom some of you will know, an American despite his name, Ernest Tanaloza, born a New Englander, born in Salem, Harvard educated, who went out in the last decades of the 19th century, I think in the 1880s, to Tokyo, with a commission from the Imperial Japanese government to, in the first instance, busy himself with the art object of the art treasures of Japan generally, to organize, catalog, the Western ideas, the great treasures of Japanese sculpture, jewelry, painting, and so on. Very extraordinary man, stayed in Japan for a long time, was also interested himself in Japanese literature, learned Japanese very well, of course. He died in the first decade of the present century. His wife, who was a writer in her own right, Mary McNeil, of Mobile, Alabama, behaved very extraordinarily and very, very intelligently indeed. She had inherited all these papers of her husband that were sort of rough drafts, but needed polishing. And she held them by her for a long time and began to read carefully the poets who were then appearing. We're now talking about the year 1909 through to 1913, 1914. Read them carefully, looking for the poet who could do the job that she knew needed to be done with her husband's papers, to make them, in fact, part of the ongoing modern movement. And I think it's too seldom realized that this lady deserves credit, because the decision that she finally made was a strikingly original and a very daring one, and she took it off her own back. Without consulting anybody, she saw some poems in Poetry in Chicago, Poetry Magazine in Chicago, by an at that time almost unknown expatriate American living in London. This was found. They were very, very original and disconcerting poems for anyone whose tastes have been formed in the Edwardian and earlier period. Nonetheless, she took the risk. Pound didn't know any Japanese. He rightly realized that was an irrelevance. She got in touch with him. She put all the manuscripts in his hands. And they were manuscripts of various sorts. And Pound's translation of them, that is to say, his making into poetry of the rough translations which Penaloza had made, account for some of his almost exquisite early works and have a profound and enormous impact. And among them were the no plays which Pound worked at with great industry, with great care, and very fast. This was also the period, we're now thinking of 1914-1915, it was also the period when Pound was was closely associated with Yeats. An association, a relationship which really reflects enormous credit on both men. Because Yeats was by the time Pound first met him, already on the strength of early books, which we now think of as very powerful, the strongest works, acclaimed as, I think it is fair to say, the preeminent poet of the English language. He's been writing and publishing for nearly 30 years. He was already in his middle age. Pound, for his part, said it was Yeats's writing, which he'd read first in America, which drew him to London in the first place. He came to learn from Yeats, to sit at Yeats's feet. But being the sort of character he was, he hadn't known Yeats for very long before he began saying, in effect, yeah, you're great, marvellous, but could be a little bit better than And, you know, as young ones, we're talking about quite different things. Wouldn't you like to hear? There's nothing in it. And Ezra, as usual, it was just generous, wanting to help, seeing the best that was being written, and always aware that it was damn good news coming up for it, but it couldn't be made just a bit better. And even better, really, or even more remarkable, really, is Yeats's response. I mean, obviously, and I think 99 people out of 100 would say, you cocky young whippersnapper. You know, not Yeats. Pound was made largely nominally. He was called Yeats' secretary. And they settled down together and worked at each other's education, which is really quite extraordinary. And this is particularly in 1915, when the pair of them and Clare were living down here in Sussex in a place called Stone Cottage. Pound, incidentally, had just married. He was on his honeymoon in Stone Cottage. He didn't let that stop him from going on with the affair. The young Mrs. Pound was very, very understanding. apart from anything else, these two extraordinary characters living in a cottage not very far from the English Channel in the time of the First World War, naturally, their English neighbours became suspicious, and naturally it was reported, and it was supposed that they were signalling these two enemy aliens were there for no good purpose, and perhaps they were signalling to U-boats and the Channel, and they were, and the police came. All of this is alluded to, incidentally, in a very scrappy but very, very amusing way in one of the Peas and Cantos on Pound, which is very remarkable and entertaining verse as well. But they did work together upon, Pound was working at this point, upon these translations of the known plays. He showed them to Yeats. They talked over them together. And in fact, the first publication of these was from a little press that Yeats and his sisters had set up in Dublin, the Koala Press. Koala Press edition of the known plays of Japan is now of extreme rarity and value. Yeats apparently took no part in the actual labour of making poetry out of Fenollosa's drafts, but certainly, though he'd been writing plays for 20 or more years, and some of them had been very great, were very famous, had a great success, he'd never been entirely satisfied with them, he'd never found the real alternative that he wanted, which would establish poetic drama as wholly distinct from not just a poor relation of the prose drama of Shaw or Ibsen. Here, in these Japanese plays, he found them. And The Dreaming of the Bones is one of the first plays that he writes, which in many ways is structured according to the conventions of the Japanese classical style. The basic perception seems obvious enough. Since people do not normally speak in verse, as if you want the verse to be a vehicle spoken from the stage which will be at least as effective and as natural to the audience as prose or conversation, then you must transform all the other theatrical properties. This is what you see him doing in a play like this. The whole thing becomes ritualized, becomes stylized. There is, of course, no stage props except those of the simplest, the most abstract. The cast is cut down to an absolute minimum, and what's more, that minimum is not defined in the way that they're defined in a play by Shaw or by Galsworthy. They are, look at it, persons in the play, three musicians, a young man, a stranger, a young girl. Just generalized, stylized figures, and their stylization insisted upon once again in that of the three main personae, two of them wear masks, and the musicians have faces made up to resemble masks. And their movements are, again, stylized and erratic. What's more, they can and are really required to do at a certain point in the play,
transform their movements into the calculated dance.
With considerable freedom, I may say, I'm talking here of the two productions of this play that I've seen, there's very considerable margin for, in fact, the producer. How much he makes of the dance. If he has actors who aren't happy with dancing, or aren't skilled in it, or aren't trained in it, then the dance need be no more than a series of quite ritual, slow pacings and turns. On the other hand, if he really does have a dancer, the thing could become almost as much ballet as it is play. Thus you have, in a play like this, the emergence of a form of drama which has as much to do with religious ritual on the one hand, and with ballet on the other, as it has to do with something like the importance of being earnest by Oscar Wilde, or Captain Brastant's conversion by George Bernard Shaw. This, but only in this way, could you recover the possibility of writing in a Shakespearean black verse. Only in this way, then, could you once again establish that the highly specific and, as might appear, marginal business of a particular episode from Irish history could take and could profit by taking on some of the properties of the great moments of poetry and dramatic poetry in the English language. The date, of course, 1916, is of the first importance. After the musicians have appeared and have sung an ominous lyric, they have the form of a chorus, which is fulfilling at any rate some of the functions of the chorus of ancient Greek drama. Then appears and speaks the young man. The young man enters praying in Irish after a few lines. Speaks three lines of verse, merely setting the scene. Remember, there is no stage props. The scene is set as it is by Shakespeare. The people talk about what is going on, and this creates it in the minds of the audience, who don't require any visual trigger. Once more the birds cry in their loneliness, but now they wheel about our heads, and now they have dropped on the grey stone to the northeast. Appear a stranger and a young girl in the costume of the past time. They wear heroic masks. The young man asks them who they are. They get into dialogue. And finally the stranger says, "You have fought in Dublin? I was in the post office, and if taken, I suppose put against a wall and shot. You know some place of refuge, have some plan or friend who will come to meet you? I am to lie at daybreak on the mountain and keep watch until an iron coracle puts in." What's the significance of the post office?
Easter Uprising.
The Easter Rising, yes, of 1916, when the strong point of the, in any case, doomed Irish rebels and the place where they held out most was the main post office in what was then Sackville Street, what is now Arnold Street in Dublin. Those of you who have been will have experienced the distinctly eerie experience of going in to buy stamps in what is one of the principal heroic monuments. But now, I mean, it's still the same post office. There's a rather splendid monument of Cahoolan, the Irish mythological hero, and a final eight-worded tribute there to the men and women, incidentally, because some of them are the women were in the first office, who held out there, who were finally, of course, taken by the British, and the men not, though the women were imprisoned and not executed. He gave a lot to say about that. One of his very greatest poems is, of course, Easter 1960, which is when the rising happened. At any rate, here then, the first man, this young man we discovered, intentionally topical, a matter of perhaps some 2 months, he's on the run, the British are looking for him, he He's got himself deviously through from Dublin over to, you remember we established this is where it is, County Clare, the ancient kingdom of Beaumont. He is there and he has to wait until a coracle, which is most of the wicker boats, the ancient wicker boats that the Arran fishermen use, comes into the coast from the Arran Islands. Presumably they will take him off and then he can hide on the islands and will be relatively safe. Meanwhile, he is looking for a place where he can safely wait because the British soldiers are know that he and his lights are there and they are hunting for them. And appears towards the end of this dialogue with the stranger. The young man is jumpy, as well he might be. What is that sound? An old horse gone astray. He has been wandering on the road all night. I took him for a man on horse. Police are out upon the roads, and the late rising, I think there was no man of us but hated to fire at soldiers who but did their duty and were not of our race. But when a man is born in Ireland and of Irish stock, when he takes part against us, I will put you safe, though living man should set his eyes upon you. I will not answer for the dead. Wonderful. I will not answer for the dead. First intimation that he indeed and his woman companion are not what they seem. They are in fact ghosts, and as we discovered before the end of the play, they are indeed the ghosts of Dermot and of de Borghilla, unable to expiate their historic guilt at having first brought the foreigner into Ireland. The nobility of that sentiment that put into the young man's hands when he speaks upon the police, of course the Irish. In the late rising, I think there was no man of us but hated to fire at soldiers who but did their duty and were not of our race. So there was no hatred against a British soldier. But when a man is born in Ireland of Irish stock, when he takes part against us, I get the impression that that is something different again, and we really hate the Irishman who is serving the British interest. An attitude which, I suppose, chivalrous to agree, might still be found among some of the Irish Republican fighters now in Lanorth, though once again it is not, certainly not what you are led to suppose. The IRA propaganda depends upon the notion that no Irishman hates another Irishman, all Irishmen are banded together in hating the English, which is not and never has been the case. Then they get to a talking of the ghosts that haunt these areas. He says he's not afraid of them. He has too much to fear from living men. Some of the language here is extraordinarily fine. He's being told about the ghosts. What he's being told is no more than what was common folk among common belief among the Irish country people. As we know from stories which Yeats had 20 years before collected and published under the title of The Celtic Twilight and other books. The young man said, well, let them dream into what shape they please and fill waste mountains with the invisible tumult of the fantastic conscience. I have no dread. They cannot put me into jail or shoot me. That juxtaposition there of extraordinarily lofty, indeed we may say rhetorical language, though the very finest sort, and rhetorical cadence too, with something as direct as they cannot put me into jail or shoot me. They cannot, the ghosts may. Let them dream into what shape they please and fill waste mountains with the invisible tumult of the fantastic conscience. Wonderful, wonderful writing. Of a very lofty sort. Everything is, we say, okay, this is blankness, this is the iambic pentameter, which we are often told is no longer a responsible vehicle for serious imaginative expression. And fill waste mountains with the invisible tumult, where the ripple of the sudden polysyllables, invisible tumult, and then the cadence that you get when you swing around that line ending, of the fantastic conscience. And every one of those words, too, is used with extraordinary exactness. Fantastic, meaning fantastic, and conscience. I mean, they all stand up, every one of these words, if you check against the Oxford English Dictionary. None of them are used sloppily. More than that we might speak of as Shakespearean. They go on talking. All this time they are climbing up the hill over the ruined abbey looking for the safe hiding place. They talk about the history of the town. The young man says, "Is there no house famous for sanctity or architecture or beauty in Clare or Kerry or in all wide Connaught? The enemy has not a roof. Close to the altar, broken by wind and frost and worn by time, Donna O'Brien has a tomb, a name in Latin. He wore fine clothes and knew the secrets of women, but he rebelled against the King of Thomond and died in his youth." "And why should he rebel?" said the young man. "The King of Thomond was his rightful master. It was men like Donna who made Ireland weak. My curse on all that troop, and when I die, I'll leave my body, if I have any choice, far from his ivy tod and his hour." There you see Gates expressing through this character a sentiment which almost certainly would not be shared by most of the men who shot him, who lived the Rose, Help, Post Office. The notion that we have seen already from later writing like the Curse of Cromwell, profoundly anti-democratic sentiments which require a man know his master and serve him. The King of Thomond was his rightful master, with men like Donna who made Ireland weak. Since, of course, this is a purely and entirely just and accurate judgment upon Irish history, as we have seen, it was because the Irish chieftains could seldom agree upon themselves, that they could never make a concerted opposition to the invader, whether it was the Norseman or the Norman or the Englishman, only rarely could they do so. There followed, but I must let you go, one of the most Dantesque passages of verse in the entire play, and I'll go on talking about that tomorrow before we pick up the narrative of Irish history.
Just one or two things that I want to continue drawing your attention to before I throw it open for discussion. I was describing yesterday how this was related to the No Plays of Japan, which Yeats came to know about because Ezra Pound was working on the drafts, and how they worked at them together, or how they Pound worked at the translations while Gates was writing this play and some others. I was describing the little book that came out, and in fact this is one of the books that I have myself, and so I thought, why wouldn't I bring it in and you could share my pleasure in it. It's a very beautiful little book, very, very frail, however. So I'm not going to pass it around, but I'll put it here for those who want to come and worship at the shrine here. Certain noble plays of Japan, from the manuscripts of Ernest Fenollosa, chosen and finished by Ezra Pound, with an introduction by William Butler Yeats, Koala Press, Churchtown, Dundrum, 1916 in Roman numerals. 350 copies of this book have been printed. This copy is number 236. Very beautifully done on the hand press by Yeats's sister. Some red print and black, very everything about it, except the footage of the binding, which is extremely frail, is a beautiful example of book design, the relationship between the print and the margins is a pleasure to the eye. And a colophon at the end, here ends a certain noble place of Japan, from the manuscripts of Ernest Penaloza, chosen and finished by Ezra Pound, printed and published by Elizabeth Corbett Gates at the Koala Press, Churchtown Dundrum, in the county of Dublin, Ireland, finished on the 20th day of July, in the year of the Sinn Féin Rising, 1916. Which brings it all together. The Rising and Ezra Pound, and Yeats and his sister in Japan, and Ernest Penaloza. This poem, The Dreaming of the Bones, he was, in fact, working at in 1916, shortly after the tragic failure of the Rising in Easter of that year. We must, of course, and we shall, as we get on with the history, you have to qualify that notion that it was a failure. It was both a failure and a success. In this, it was, of course, suppressed, and the leaders were imprisoned, or in the case of the men, executed. But then, the extraordinary thing was that it never was intended in those worldly terms to succeed. It was, in any event, a doomed symbolic gesture. And so in the long run, and this was how Yeats saw it himself, as the leaders themselves saw it, in the long run it was a success, because it was a long time since there had been heroic martyrs in the nationalist Irish nationalist cause. The men who fought in 1916 created another body of martyrs, and in that way ensured that sooner or later, the struggle with the British would be fought to a finish. They were not, it may have removed any possibility of parliamentary compromise. In that sense, long after the men had died, and really because they died, it succeeded. So it was a very, very, we can't say, it was both a failure and a success. The Dreaming of the Bones was the first of several plays which Yeats wrote on the model, on the no-play model, of four of them which he subsequently printed. They're very tightly related. In fact, The Dreaming of the Bones is the first of them, published some years later as four Plays for Dancers, which pinpoints what he was attempting here, to make a form of play which should have as much to do with ritual ballet and ceremony. A ceremony, a ritual, not a naturalistic era, certainly not a slice of life. All of those things he had long regarded as what, in fact, was emasculating the drama. I spoke yesterday about the Dantesque. The note of Dante in this play and in the verse of it. This it is really very hard to specify, and I'm not going to attempt it. I'm going to read a couple more passages which seem to me to be Dantesque, but that's purely impressionist on my part. Plainly it is Dantesque in the sense that the central image of the play, and it really is only one image, when they go into the dance, the doomed ghosts, Dermid and Evogilla, does recall, and they certainly meant to recall, the equally doomed spiral of the lovers in the Inferno, Paolo and Francesca, one of the most famous passages of the Divine Comedy. And I will only say to you now that if you have never yet found it convenient to read any part of the Divine Comedy in a reasonable translation, if you haven't got the Italian, as most of us haven't, this is a very good time to do it. if you were to choose to hunt up the particular canto, I think it is the fourth or the fifth, very near the translation by Lawrence Binion.
Well, that would, again, be
a very handy thing to do just about now. The whole history of Dante's presence in English poetry, and American too, incidentally, is a very fascinating one. I'm tempted to embark upon it, but won't. He was known. I mean, his work was known to Chaucer, and it was also known to Milton, Dante's work. Then, except for rather unusual people, in fact, the Divine Comedy tends to fall out of the canon of things that English poets read and comment upon. He is rediscovered, if one might say, at the end of the 18th century by the Romantics. And indeed, partly it was because of a very fine translation into blank verse that came out in the first decade of the 19th century, associated with the name of Carey, Carey's Dante, which is one of the most distinguished pieces of verse translation in English literature. Because of that, he was available, Dante was available to John Keats, who otherwise didn't have any Italian, couldn't get at it directly. And when Keats, at the end of his life, was writing his fragmentary epic Hyperion, the second Hyperion, the second revision that he made, was, again, deliberately Dantesque. He was trying to make it a Dantesque poem, using Carey's translation to do it with. Others, of course, Shelley and Byron, of the Romantic generation, knew Italian well, lived in Italy for many years, certainly read Dante in the original, and some of the most remarkable poems of both of them are those in which they attempt, in very different ways, to, again, bring over the Dantesque into English. Since then, Dante has been a permanent presence in English poetry, and as I say, in American, because when you get to Longfellow, he too is very much aware of Dante in some of his writings. It is one of the things that, in particular, with a new intensity, once again, this generation, as we think of them, though they're not really the same generation, these three great poets who knew each other, Eliot, Pound, and Yeats, differing very widely on almost everything else, one thing that they have in common is a profound and intense wish to emulate Dante and the Divine Comedy. It would hardly be too much to say that for Eliot and Pound, at any rate, Dante takes the place that one would more normally associate with Shakespeare. And again, any of you who do in fact have Italian and who are really interested in Dante, there is a learned book to be written, there is a learned study to be made, which would be not just learned but also extremely illuminating, about Dante as the common aspiration of all three of these poets. This is abundantly documented in the case of Eliot and Pound, both of whom have written at length in prose about Dante and his style. In Yeats it is more putative, but in fact it is just as strong, and there is sufficient evidence. Another thing that is worth saying here is that we tend to think, and some of the textbooks that we read invite us to think, that modern poetry, which is supposed to just happen suddenly, is defined as being everything that Romantic poetry was not, a revolt against the 19th century. And this is the way that we used to be asked, at any rate, to approach all these three poets and the poetry of our own time in our language. A reaction against Romanticism. Well, in fact, this won't hold up for a minute, and the example of Dante is one particular example of how it won't hold up. This is, in fact, a solid continuity between Shelley and Eliot and Yeats, for instance. The passage that I think of as Dantesque, I mean, an example of it, is where the young girl says, she is, of course, de Morgilla, and he is gradually realizing that that is who she is. Still talking, she's talking about herself and Dermot, but still talking about them in the third person, because she's not yet brought herself to the point at which she reveals that she's talking about them, and to make the appeal to him, forgive us so that we can kiss. And of course he refuses to forgive. Here she's still talking about this doomed couple as if they were other people. Although they have no blood or living nerves, for once they warm and live the livelong night in one another's arms, and know their part in life, being now but of the people of dreams, is a dream's part. Although they are but shadows hovering between a thorn tree and a stone, who have heaped up night on wigger night, although no shade, however harried and consumed, would change his own calamity for theirs, their manner of life were blessed could their lips a moment meet. But when he had bent his head close to her head, or hand would slip in hand, the memory of their crime flows up between and drives them apart. Those lines, no shade, however harried and consumed, would change his own calamity for theirs. Also, the extraordinarily elaborate grammatical sentence. This is all one sentence, it's a very elaborate one indeed. And it's flawlessly, grammatically correct. Although no shade, however harried and consumed, would change his own calamity for theirs, their manner of life were blessed could their lips a moment meet. But when their manner of life were blessed, their manner of life would be blessed. It is a very elegant and sophisticated use of the subjunctive, technically. Subjunctives are very rare. I mean, you can get by without using them at all. Yeats uses them a great deal. In this, he represents what is something that was not altogether, it was not to be altogether typical of 20th century poetry. Something that is not really typical, for instance, of Found or at all often of it, no more of any kind of Found. The actual use of the rules of grammar or the structure of a sentence as the structuring of a passage of verse. And that, too, is like Dante in Italian. Here's another example of what I call that elegant subjunctive. The young man. Oh, watch, hold on. So here we're on the summit. I can see the Aran Islands, Connemara Hills, the Galway, and the breaking light. There, too, the enemy has toppled roof and gable and torn the panelling from ancient rooms. What generations of old men had known like their own hands and children, whether that has boiled a trooper's porridge. That town had lain, but for the pair that you would have me pardon, amid its gables and its battlements like any old admired Italian town. For though we have neither coal nor iron ore to make us wealthy and corrupt the air, our country, if that crime were uncommitted, had been most beautiful. Well, there the hads. That town had lain but for, is that town that we see, which is the town of Galway, looking down on, would have lain before us like any admired, old admired Italian town. And then, astonishingly, really, again, this is like Dante, in the middle of it, an entirely exact and accurate statement of economic and industrial fact that the west of Ireland does not have notable mineral deposits. For though we have neither coal nor iron ore to make us wealthy and corrupt the air, our country, if that crime were uncommitted, had been most beautiful. Again, those are subjunctives. Our country, if that crime of them had never been committed, would have been most beautiful. Oh, right.
about the use of the folding and unfolding of the cloth, or the black cloth. Does that have any particular meaning in this play, or does he use that in any of his other plays?
Yes, he does. Whether it has a precedent in the performance of the Japanese no drama, I am not clear. I'm not sure. You could soon find out, particularly by looking up Pound's book about it. It is, of course, the equivalent of the curtain being drawn up. But the whole point is, of course, that he just does not want the proscenium arch and the curtain, which then is drawn back, and there we have a room with one wall taken out, a slice of life, a photographic illusion. That is the last thing we want. We don't want that sort of realistic illusion. We want something which is stylized and ceremonial. Hence, as it were, the folding and unfolding of a cloth is like an abstract symbolic equivalent of the curtains of the proscenium arch coming back. From one point of view, he's getting near to theatre in the round, in fact, is what he wants. There are to be no illusory tricks. You are to see the actors coming. You are not to suppose that you've suddenly erupted into somebody's life who is unaware of you. They are aware of you as you are aware of them. The thing is, and so the folding and unfolding of the cloth. It can be done. Let me say, I've seen two performances of this play. It can be extremely effective with a sort of stripped, spare quality about the experience, which makes you feel that most of the other theatre experiences you have are sort of messy. I've seen it done in a theatre, therefore with a proscenium stage, in Dublin. And it certainly, Yeats didn't mean it to be done. It can be done there, but that destroys the effect. When you're there in the theatre, and there is the orchestra pit, and the footlights, and then beyond the stage. That was not what he intended. A better performance, therefore.